collaborative.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jeff Charlotte is the son of a Jewish father and a Pentecostalist Hindu Buddhist mother. Peter Manso is the son of a Catholic priest and a former nun. That's just where the story starts. The two friends and colleagues loaded up their religious baggage and a saucy point of view and set off on a cross-country road trip to look at the wild and woolly spiritual passions of contemporary America. They found holy dirt eaters in New Mexico, gangbangers in Los Angeles tattooing Jesus on their bullet-ridden bodies, a one-eyed rodeo preacher in Texas saving more calves than souls. Charlotte and Manso wrapped their discoveries up in one big idea: kill the Buddha. That is to say, sometimes you need to destroy your own assumptions about God and faith to find truth. These two 21st century Dharma bums have made their way home now, and with a little help from some friends, have written a quite unusual book. They call it A Heretic's Bible. Tonight on Point, Killing the Buddha, a gonzo look into the rich and strange tapestry of American spiritual expression today. What do you make of the teeming, stunning variety of American spiritual expression? Are America's new seekers tuned into idols, to fantasy, to God, to all of the above? Is the American soul more lost or found these days? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio are Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, co-authors of the new book, Killing the Buddha, A Heretic's Bible. Good evening and welcome, Peter Manso.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us.
And good evening and welcome, Jeff Charlotte.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you both. With us also tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack, you old seeker, you.
I'm still looking. Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hello, Jack.
Well, so here we are. And you guys have been out on the road and looking at what's going on in some pretty funky corners of American seeking. What were you looking for out there, Peter Manso?
Well, we figured going in that we would know it when we found it. We set off about 2 years ago in our rusted Ford Tempo, just looking for stories. We knew we would drive south and then west and then north, just asking around and looking for God on the ground.
Tell us your personal story. How did you two meet, Jeff?
We met at an organization called the National Yiddish Book Center. This was back around 1997, and I was editing a magazine called Pockentrager, which was an English-language magazine of Yiddish culture. And Peter had been hired to help design exhibits. And we got to talking about Yiddish literature, which is a little bit obscure, but we saw that there's a lot of lessons in Yiddish literature for the way we think about writing about other stories. And I think that is what got us started toward Killing the Buddha.
So there's a fascinating combination here, very unusual. On the one hand, you've got this kind of Dharma bum, Hunter Thompson tour of the nation where you get into the sort of snake handling world. I don't think you literally have snake handling, but you've got a lot of handling almost everything else in here. Woven through that, you've got a dozen books of the Bible rewritten in entirely contemporary circumstances, prose, with greater or lesser degrees of huge artistic freedom in how people have rewritten here. But first came the stories that you found on the road. To understand those, I feel like we need to understand a little bit about where you each come from in spiritual terms, in religious terms. I don't know how to put it. Peter Manso, what's your religious starting point?
Well, I suppose, as you mentioned, my religious starting point is this fact that my father is a Catholic priest and my mother was a nun.
How did that happen?
Good question. How it happened was they were both Catholic religious stationed in the city of Boston in the 60s, in this time of great ferment in the Catholic world, post-Vatican II. A lot of Catholic religious believed that their church was changing much more quickly than it actually ended up changing. So they were married in the late 60s, sort of to force the church's hand. They believe it was a time when the church should change in a certain way, and they hoped that their own church would catch up with them.
So when you jumped in the Ford Tempo to go out onto that great ocean of American spirituality, what were you taking with you? Were you coming as a Christian, as a Catholic, as a lapsed Christian, as a Buddhist? I have no idea. What were you carrying?
Oh, I was...
How are you defining yourself?
I was a... Um, I was a lapsed Catholic with a monastic obsession who was interested in Yiddish literature.
Ooh, okay. All right. We got it. We'll chalk that one up. And Jeff Charlotte, Jewish father, Pentecostal, Hindu, Buddhist mother. There are some seekers in your own family here.
Yeah. My father was Jewish, but I was raised by my mother in a small town. It was very anti-Semitic, and that was probably my first lesson in religion, was anti-Semitic slurs every day. My mother, who had been raised Pentecostal, ended up exploring Hinduism and Buddhism all the time, taking my sister and I to churches, temples, synagogues, ashrams, largely on the basis of where we would hear good music and where our friends were in the choir or ringing bells or somehow part of the service.
So when the tempo pulled onto the highway of American life a couple of years ago, how were you defining yourself religiously?
I think that I was defining myself at that point as my practice is writing about religion. If I have a religious practice, that's it. And that's probably still true, although in very different ways than from when we first started, I think.
All right. So we have to hear some stories here. But you begin right at the beginning of the book. There's this very Buddhist cast. It's kind of, I don't know if it's intended or not, but to the whole thing, this idea of, I mean, you name it, killing the Buddha, obviously it's intentional. But we defined that in our opening here, but I don't know if we defined it the way you would, Peter Mann. So this ninth century story of Lin Shi telling his acolyte to kill the Buddha, what's it mean?
Well, the way the story goes is that, yes, his monk had, after years of meditation, had an experience, a nirvana experience of meeting the Buddha on the road, of meeting what he was looking for. And his teacher, of course, more experienced than he, told him to be suspicious of finding things so easily.
Kill the Buddha, meaning puncture right through this notion that you've found, God, Jeff Charlotte?
Yeah, the moment you think you have all the answers, the moment you think it's all wrapped up and you know who God is and you know what your relation is, that's when you kill the Buddha. That's when you start asking questions. And those questions are going to take you in all sorts of different directions, probably far, far away from that position of certainty at which you began.
So as I read you then, you found Americans finding all kinds of Buddhas, metaphorically here, finding all kinds of images of ecstasy and engagement with the spiritual on the road. Peter Mansell, jump in. Give us a sense of what you found out there.
Well, we found really... When we talk about people finding Buddhas and meeting them and we suggest that they should kill them, it's not merely religious people. It's people with all sorts of assumptions and even a skeptic's assumption that all religious people are after pie in the sky and whatnot. Well, in fact, it's a bit more complicated than that. And that is the secular Buddha is a tough Buddha to kill.
All right. But Jeff, tell us exactly what you found out there. Give us some of these situations you found yourself in. As I recall, there was an off-ramp. You saw someone standing there saying, miracles, this exit took you right on in. What did you see?
It was a sign, the sign on the side of the road that said, it's here, it's here, it's here, and had been handwritten and scrawled. And what was supposed
to be— This was somewhere in the Carolinas.
Henderson, North Carolina, calls itself the Gateway to the South, leaving Virginia entirely out of the picture. And the miracle that was supposed to have been there was at first four clouds, E-S-U-S, and the man who—
Four clouds arrayed in the sky.
In the sky. And,
yes.
And E-S-U-S, of course, doesn't spell anything, mm-hmm. and so they did not consider that a miracle until the fifth cloud, a J, floated along. That was a miracle. They took pictures, put them in the shack, locked it up, and you had to pay $300 to see the pictures. So rather than do that, we bought a newspaper for 25 cents, headline— told us a story about a hermaphrodite gunman, that's their language,
yes.
who had attacked a local church calling Americans our killers. And we knew something was interesting there. This was not a tabloid. This was a small town newspaper. Mm-hmm. So we just started talking to people. Soon we found ourselves at the church in prison talking to the hermaphrodite. And
Who was the gunner? Who did it turn out to be, Peter?
Well, they never really knew, in fact, in part because he or she always had a different name. To the arresting officers, he said his name was Christie. To us, he said his name was Ishizin Zin. And to us, a second time when we met him up in prison, he told us his name had seven letters with his real name hidden behind the last one. He was pretty clearly a disturbed person in many ways.
And the church that he came into, what was your sense of that, Peter?
The church was a very small family holiness church in rural North Carolina. They had never seen anything like this before, of course, but they had an immediate theological interpretation of it, and the way they interpreted it was that, of course, this was a sign of the end times. This person whom they could not quite explain with their usual categories was clearly possessed by demons. And the way they should respond to this threat to their church was to pray the demons right off of that person.
Give us another moment on the road, Jeff Charlotte. What did you find out there?
We had heard that paganism is one of the fastest growing religions in the military. And this is true. So we
in the U.S. military?
In the military. And the Air Force...
They don't put that in the ads.
Not yet. Not yet. But in fact, chaplains now do have to be trained in giving the Wiccan rites for soldiers who are killed. And this has been contested at various levels in military court. So we wanted to find out about that. That ended up leading us to a gathering of about 2,000 mostly naked pagans in the, sort of in the middle of Kansas, many of them military people. And we spent several days practicing their worship with them, which surprised us by just how wholesome it was.
What variety of paganism was this? I mean, what would their practice look like?
Well, there was could be a pagan or a heathen or a Wiccan. Some people would worship a god they called the Horn God, which would sound to us like the devil. Other people would be very serious worshippers of Loki or Thor.
Okay, they're naked, they're worshiping the Horn God, and it looks very wholesome to you.
Well, from a distance, it might not look so wholesome.
There fill in the picture for us.
Well, there is a cabin-sized column of heavy timber bursting into blue and yellow flames, and there are these writhing naked pagans dancing all around it. And the very interesting thing that we found is that it was not sexualized whatsoever. They were interested in being naked and being muddy, but they were not, no one felt threatened, no one felt at risk.
And what was the gist? What were they looking for? What were they looking to express in their spiritual quest, naked with the Horn Guy?
That's a good question. And it runs the gambit. Some people just come to these things to drum and drink, they say. They just want to bang their drums and drink their mead, and that's what they're after. Others, they're really communing with something. And what it is exactly, only they could say.
Jack Beatty, these two Dharma bums found, holy strippers and one-eyed cowboy preachers and, you know, murder victims, churches worshiping or praying for the murderer, and just all sorts of wild and woolly Americans out there. The New York Observer headline on a review of their book calls it an orgy of skeptical ecstasy. What do you make of this quest, Jack?
Well, as I hear it, and I looked at their website, they're trying to juxtapose religion and spirituality. I mean, it does seem to me that religion deals in certainty and dogma, and that's part of its comfort. I saw recently, we mentioned on this program, that three times as many Americans believe in the Immaculate Conception as believe in evolution. Well, and the Immaculate Conception is a religious doctrine, and believing in that gives people, you know, some kind of certainty. But as I hear what they're talking about, they're saying there's this other sort of antinomian spirituality out there that's not about any kind of dogma at all, but about a kind of restless and sometimes even sort of mock comic seeking. And that, unless I'm mistaken, they're partly trying to celebrate that. But I may be wrong.
Jeff Charlotte, is Jack on track there? Are you celebrating the doctrine-free exuberance of American spirituality?
I think we're very impressed by it. We're impressed by the sincerity of it. I wouldn't say it's doctrine-free. The pagans, in fact, are extremely dogmatic. They have various rules about spells you can do and spells you can't. The people, the Pentecostals who had the exorcism for this person who attacked their church, are also dealing with a historical doctrine. What we found time and time again, in fact, is that this divide between religion and spirituality, which works maybe on a sociological level, tends to break down just by the fact that so many of the pagans called themselves born-again Christians. So many of the people we met who were recognizable as fundamentalist Christians also believed in magic.
Well, we've got a great big mixed-up picture out there. We're looking at it tonight, talking about the new book, Killing the Buddha. kind of off-the-map guide to the rich, strange tapestry of American spiritual life today, a heretic's Bible, in the phrase of the authors. With me tonight, Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte. You can join our conversation. What do you make of the teeming variety of American spiritual expression today? And are America's seekers tuned in to idols, to fantasy, to God, to all of the above? Do you recognize the soul-thirsty freaks and fellow travelers these Dharma bums have found? Are you one of them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new book, Killing the Buddha, an off-the-road map or guide to the rich tapestry of American spiritual life today, some orthodox, some very unorthodox. My guests tonight are the authors of the book, Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, with me in the studio. You can join our conversation tonight. Can organized religion contain today's exuberant and personal spiritual energy in the United States? Are these scoffing Dharma bums too quick to kill the Buddha? Would you like to set them loose on your religious faith or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter Manso, I wish you'd give us just a little bit of a reading to get a sense. Take us to the church in Henderson, North Carolina. Or, I'm sorry, Jeff, maybe you'll read this for us, where you ran into the hermaphrodite gun person, as the local headline had it.
So the members of the church decided to have an exorcism, and they insisted that we join in.
This is after the gun-wielding incident that shocked the church.
Mm-hmm. And they asked that we join in. We told them that we felt uncomfortable because we didn't share their belief, and they said that didn't matter. Their belief was so powerful. Lord, called Buddy, we're praying to you now in the name of your most holy son, Jesus. Glory, Wesley hollered. Hallelujah. Lord, shouted Buddy. We know you're in that prison cell with that soul who brought a weapon into your house, and we know the devil's there, too. Billy Joe began mumbling his prayer like an engine revving at a stoplight, waiting for the signal to change. Heavenly Father, we pray that you come before us this night. We pray for your presence and your blessing, your mercy, Heavenly Father. Buddy rolled on. Lord, we ask you in your most holy name to expel those demons from that lost person, to wash him or her in your loving mercy, to make free his soul of demonic possession. Billy Sr. stood dead still in the center, his arms up, his fingers fluttering like a dainty goodbye. His prayer was a steady beat under the others. Come on down, Jesus. Come on down, Jesus. Come on down, Jesus.
There's just a glimpse of an exorcism in a church in Henderson, North Carolina, that had felt, I'm sure, violated by the gun-wielding intruder. What did you make of this moment? Did you put this, Peter Manso, in a fully Christian context, on a kind of extra doctrinal Christian context? What was going on there?
It was Christian, certainly, but not Christian in any way that I had been raised, and so it felt extremely foreign and extremely claustrophobic, actually, to be in this small room, locked in a prayer circle with these four men whom we just met, who really were as suspicious of us as they were as they had been of the gunman.
Did they feel they succeeded in their exorcism?
They did feel they had succeeded.
What was the sign? How did they know?
Oh, they just knew. I suppose the Lord told them, and they at the end of it they had felt the presence of God in the room, and that was the sign that they needed.
Jeff, Peter, take us to the other side then, to the and there are many examples in the book, but take us to that pagan hoedown in Kansas that you attended. I think it was Heartland, Kansas.
Yes, as I said, this is a yearly gathering of pagans in the middle of the country, in the middle of a cornfield. Out in a patch of land, a group of pagans owned together. So when we got there, this is what we saw. There were many, many witches, not to mention troll people, those who believe they are part troll, the way some say they are part Cherokee, as well as vampires and halflings and full-blood Vikings, radical fairies and mischievous elves, and strutting around in kilts and tartan, communicating by walkie-talkie, some big, badass druids providing security. Some of the druids were bikers. Many of the magic people were military, lifers and grunts and NCOs. There were also construction workers, Jiffy Lube mechanics, a major contingent from Kinko's. They came to the festival in campers and rusty RVs and souped-up Chevy two-tons. They came in pup tents and under tarps and, in some cases, under trees. They brought toddlers and teenagers and their grandmothers. All told, there were well over 1,000 pagans gathered for the festival's opening ritual, standing in a circle around the makings of a serious bonfire, a cabin-sized column of heavy timber which the keepers of the flame, sooty, muscular, bare-chested men with axes, had been hewing and stacking for days, in which they had topped with an enormous hollowed-out log with a bearded face, a likeness of the Horned One to whom they prayed. There were also worshippers of the witch goddess Hecate, and of the Norse trickster god Loki, more popular among gay pagans than his straight-arrow brother Thor. There were devotees of the ancient mother and of the Roman war god Mars, of the Green Man and of Isis, of Herne the Hunter and of the bitch goddess, she of uncountable memories. There were women in black velvet robes and men with great gnarled staves, and despite the mist of precipitation, the fog of cold breath, and the 2 days of rain and mud, a lot of mud, that had preceded the opening ritual, there were naked pagans everywhere. Some whose nudity seemed like a gift to all who beheld them, others whose raw nakedness was just plain raw. There were drums, constant, unrelenting, and there was chanting, some like the barking of congested seals, some like the singing of drunk Midwestern angels. Bells tinkled. A little boy riding on his mother's shoulders shouted, "Yay!" with genuine joy. It was time for the ritual to begin.
Wow. Charlotte, what did you make of this? What was everybody searching for in that cornfield in Kansas?
They were searching for a almost kind of a transcendental Thoreau-like contact. Remember when Thoreau climbs up to the top of Mount Katahdin looking for some contact with God, and he gets it more than he's prepared for. And that happened there as well. The ritual proceeded in kind of a drizzly, schleppy way. It didn't actually take off until, as Peter was talking about before, this great bonfire.
Whoosh.
Whoosh. And everyone felt it. Now, what do they feel? That's hard to say. At the very least, they felt community. And I think that's a constant that's occurring out there, is a searching for community, people who don't want to bowl alone, so to speak, trying to find ways to make religion work for them, or spirituality, but because so much of what has come before is no longer working.
So you guys clearly had some fun with this along the way, and as the New York Observer has it, they call it a skeptical ecstasy that you brought to all this. But in the end, Peter, were you looking at this? Did you see, was this the Buddha, all this stuff, the Buddha that needs to be killed? Was this the illusory, fake or half-baked expression of spirituality? Is that what you're suggesting here, or are Americans climbing into some kind of new cockpit?
Well, I don't believe that killing the Buddha, this as a concept and as an idea, is about debunking. In fact, it can be, because some beliefs out there, let's face it, are nonsense, and there are charlatans in religion as much as there are in business, of course. But what was surprising to me, traveling to all these places and meeting all these people, was the extent to which it was also heartfelt and sincere. Before I had gone to a pagan festival, I would have rolled my eyes at these characters. I really would have.
Yeah, fairies and elves and powerful druids and okay.
Now, having met them, I wonder, what is their life that they need to believe that a woman needs to believe that she is an elf? What is her life that she needs to believe that? So, sure, in one level it's nonsense and it's play acting, but on the other, in another level, she is this elf woman who is getting something that she needs. And
yeah, Jack Beatty, it's remarkable. It's easy to think of these things as far away in a field in Kansas, but I think a lot of us, I expect our listeners, have felt this closer to home than you might expect. I had it, and my father's sister said to me a few years ago, I saw something hanging around her neck, and in a couple minutes she's telling me that she's really into the bitch goddess Gaia. I've got a cousin who teaches at a cowboy church, preaches now and then when he gets the spirit moves him in Farmer City, Illinois. I mean, Jack, this is not just, this is out there, this is happening. Teeming is the word.
Well, it is, and there are lots of folks who are caught in what Max Weber called the iron cage of rationality. That's the phrase he used to describe a bureaucratic capitalist civilization that was surrounded by this iron cage. And being a rationalist is not for the faint at heart. I mean, I'm looking now at a picture of a dog, Duke, a brindled German short-haired pointer, whom I love dearly, whose remains are now in a tin that I have downstairs. It's very hard to accept that that's it, that that's me, that that's all. And that's part of the iron cage of rationality, that you die, you're dead. And the impulse to people the world with spirit and magic, anything to overcome that grim fact that that beast I loved is gone and I'm going to be gone too, and everything I love and everyone I know is gone, is going to go. That is the bitterest, hardest thing in the world.
But this used to get channeled down some pretty narrow paths in the United States, Jack. I mean, of course, there's always been religious diversity, but there was also a big, wide mainstream that was kind of, you know, buttoned down and church-going, and that's where you were supposed to look for this.
Well, that's true, but, there have been these great awakenings. There was one in the early 17th century. There was one in the early 19th century. And some people think we're in a third today where the old time, you know, as you say, the established sort of ranks are not enough for people. They're not giving them enough of that spiritual, if not answer, the feeling that someone out there cares about them. Maybe it's the elf god. I don't, whoever it is. But that notion that universe just isn't benignly indifferent to us. Boy, I can understand how that generates all kinds of fantasies from organized religion, in my view, to the fairies and the elves. I mean, there's a continuity that these fellows are talking about of the magical element from the even our friends the Episcopalians,
yes,
from God's frozen people all the way to these elves and fairies.
And a lot of hands reaching out for it. We're talking tonight with Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, co-authors of the new book, Killing the Buddha. You can join us. Do you recognize the soul-thirsty freaks and fellow travelers these Dharma bums have found? Are you one of them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David is calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
My question is very narrow, very specific. I teach at an excellent Orthodox Jewish day school in the Boston area.
Okay.
And my question is, during their odyssey, their journeys, did they notice a difference specifically in the teenagers' spiritual awakening in the South versus, let's say, the Northeast?
The geographic differences in the awakening of teenagers regionally. Jeff, Charlotte?
I think much less than you'd expect. That's the sort of the standard line, is the South is religious, and maybe we here in Boston like to think that we are firmly rational.
This is kind of Howard Dean's line of late, but you didn't find it that regionally differentiated?
No, it's really everywhere. We started our trip in New York, and New York, people don't like to think about this perhaps, but New York is actually the largest Pentecostal city in the world. The Pentecostal is the sort of the holiness charismatic religion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not
speaking
in the South.
Speaking in tongues, all that.
Exactly. You can, if you want to speak in tongues, you can find a place in every block in Brooklyn to do that. And I think that's also throughout the North. In the South, it was the same thing. The Midwest is perhaps still a little bit more Orthodox, and mainline churches survive there in a way that they are dwindling elsewhere.
And what about among the young, Peter Manso, our caller asked specifically about teenagers? I mean, I don't know. This was a pretty flying journey that you took. It's not scientific, but did you come away with a sense of where this sort of bubbling new or old stuff is bubbling highest among what age group?
Oh, I do think that there is definitely something happening among teenagers now that wasn't happening when I was a teenager, which was only 15 years ago. And really, I think that has a lot to do with the internet, actually. I mean, it's easy to thank the internet for all kinds of things, but there are so many more opportunities for learning open to kids these days, that they're able to learn that there is some other way to be religious than maybe your Sunday school class, which turns you off, or maybe you're not getting what you need in church on Sunday, and instead of just shutting off that side of them entirely, they find other ways to do it.
David, I'm curious about your question. You teach young people. Do you see regional differences? Why do you ask?
Because I've mostly worked in the Northeast, and occasionally I've worked in the South, and I thought there might have been a slight difference in terms of the passion of the kids. I've noticed that in the Northeast they tend to be a little bit more passionate. I just want to see if that was true in other areas of religion as well.
Yeah, interesting question. Thanks for calling tonight, David. Vika's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Vika. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm very much enjoying the program, and it's certainly true here in the Northeast that the non-mainstream religions are ever more visible. But the questions about the debunking the alternative seem a little bit misplaced to me, since so many self-professed followers of mainstream religions, and I'm, of course, particularly thinking about Christianity, not only don't feel their religion, but do not even follow, you know, its most basic precepts. So why is there so much default suspicion that's mixed into our curiosity?
Well, stick with us, Vika. I want to put that to our guests here. Vika is listening tonight and hearing debunking, and maybe that comes with a skeptical ecstasy kind of framing. How much debunking, how much default suspicion are you bringing to the margins here, Peter Manso? Well, is she got it right? Or at least as you intended it.
We don't intend to be debunkers, actually. We intend to encounter most religious phenomena with the same, to treat them all as being equal, actually. We started with Yiddish, and I think a Yiddish linguist once said that a language is a dialect with an army. And something similar could be said for these alternative traditions. Give them time. They will soon not be alternative, but mainstream traditions.
Vika, do you hear, if to the extent that there's an element of debunking there, is it going after you?
Oh, goodness, no. What I heard was actually more suspicion in your questions than in what the authors were reading of their opinion or of their observations. It's just sort of, and I do feel that your questions are right on with regards how people who don't know about, you know, alternative religions usually approach them and approach questioning them and approach their own curiosity about them.
Yeah. So. Well, let me dive that way a little bit, Vika, and thanks for your call. I mean, we've just begun to touch on the stories that you guys tell. If we could lay them all out here, maybe some of that tone would make more sense to people. I mean, you've got the stripper in Illinois, Jeff. Describe her spiritual path. It runs through stripping.
Yeah, the book is modeled roughly on the Bible. So when it came time to do a book of Revelation, we thought, well, we'll talk to a stripper.
It's one kind of revealing.
It's one kind of revealing. And we happened to be sort of stuck on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. And here's this strange, sort of surreal place. We walk in and we sit down and they ask us, what are you there for? And we say, we're writers. What do you write about? We write about religion. And this was indeed a surreal place.
It was a strip club.
It was a strip bar. And everyone had a story to tell. And they all wanted to sit down and all the come-ons and the, you know, it was all gone. It was just sit down and one person's telling us about being raised a Calvinist. And one particular woman who said she was Jewish and Catholic turned out to be an amazing storyteller. And she heard about what we did and she wanted to be in the book. And she would start thinking sort of free form, trying to come up with prayers that we would include. And we thought they were indeed quite beautiful. And this was a sort of a democratic kind of religion. We weren't interested in debunking that. The question of this, is this true or false, is we think almost beside the point.
So we don't know about debunking, but we're certainly having our vision stretched here tonight with Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, authors of the new book, Killing the Buddha. You can join the conversation. Is America's soul more lost or found these days? And what quest are you on? Are you stripping? Are you handling snakes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new book, Killing the Buddha, an off-the-map guide to the rich, sometimes strange tapestry of American religious life today. My guests are Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, both joining me here in the studio, the co-authors of the book. You can join the conversation as well. Can organized religion contain today's exuberant and personal spiritual energy in America? What quest are you on? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter, Jeff, there's an aspect of the book we haven't even talked about, though it's at least half the book, maybe more. You have, as you say, Jeff, structured this as a kind of version of the Bible, very broadly speaking. You describe your observations and strange tales from across the country as the Psalms of the book. But you've got another dozen sort of rewritten, represented books of the Bible, as it were here, Genesis and Exodus, Leviticus,
right on down through Ezekiel, Jonah, Gospels, Revelation. Who wrote these? How did this come in? What are you doing in these segments?
All along, we knew that we were dissatisfied with the way stories about religion get told in America as sort of one voice. One voice is no more true than one God in some ways, or one story about one God. So we wanted to bring in other people. We wanted to create a congregation, a kind of choir. And we asked novelists and poets, people whom we deem sort of modern-day heretics, to take a book of the Scripture and remake it, however the Spirit so led them. And whether that led to getting lost or found, that was up to them. So Francine,
tell us some of the people who contributed.
Francine Prose writes her own book of Exodus about leaving Passover behind. Rick Moody writes a book of Jonah as a gay Jewish fantasia. Leti D.M. Twee writes Ruth about taking her mother back to Vietnam for her funeral. Haven Kimmel writes Book of Revelation as Book of Revelation.
And some of these are recognizable as retellings of the biblical stories. Others are entirely floating free.
Yeah.
At least in their detail.
All the people we spoke to, they had to get it. They had to understand what we were doing. So some people chose to sort of depart radically from the text. I think theologians and religious people will recognize the presence of the text within it nonetheless, and some people stayed closer. The common denominator was that we keep the book moving, that their stories and our stories interact in almost kind of a call and response of these outside writers and in ourselves, each telling stories that carried the narrative forward.
There's a terrific Song of Songs in here, very erotic, but very celebratory at the same time. Who wrote that?
By Darcy Stankia, a wonderful novelist whose last novel was Jesus Saves. And she's a great case in point because she'd originally started to do the Song of Songs, which is in the Bible as well, a very sexy,
yes,
sensual
is.
Book. But she said, well, I'm going to explore the inherent violence in it. But when she sat down to do it, the sort of beautiful sensuality of this book overcame her. So that way, and I think a lot of readers will think this is a naughty book, that's actually a very orthodox reading. And in a way, her story of her relationship to the divine being a kind of a conglomeration of every person she's ever had sex with.
And absolutely charged with passion that takes it right on up. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Fred is calling from Derry, New Hampshire. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hello. Excellent show, as always. I just wanted to make two quick points
yeah.
and then kind of a question.
Okay.
I went for a number of years. I don't anymore, but I still am sober. I've been through AA. And millions of people who found God, not so much in a church, but possibly in the church basement at an AA meeting.
Where Alcoholics Anonymous would meet.
Yeah.
And what's the path? How does you're saying AA gets people on a path towards spirituality. How? Why, Fred?
Well, the idea isn't Buddhist so much as far as the void or empty and awake, as much as a higher power of one's own understanding. And the only caveat usually is as long as it's good and bigger than you are. And so folks have different paths of their own personal relationship, which is defined to me as spirituality, the difference between spirituality, religion, and spirituality being the lone relationship developed with the higher power,
mm-hmm.
and religion being, you know, rules, relegate.
Maybe that's part of the generator here that's spinning Americans off in lots of very personal directions. Fred, that's an interesting insight. Peter, how about it? Do you see a kind of 12-step launch pad behind what you found out in the country?
Well, certainly, speaking about finding God in the church basement, people are finding God in all kinds of places where you might not expect. One story that we do tell in the book is a man who chases tornadoes is his way of communing with God. And similarly, it is just a matter of a higher power of his own understanding. It's just a matter of finding what that force which you know is larger than yourself.
Tom's calling from Stoughton, Wisconsin. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello. I would like to say something about religion and spirituality. That
please, yeah.
Jesus said that its truth is set people free from the corruption, and sin is that which corrupts people because sin is the transgression of God's moral laws,
mm-hmm.
and it destroys human relationships and destroys life, and it separates them from God, and all the faults religions and false spirituality is just a form of godliness, but they really are rejecting God's moral laws.
So when you look at, back on that, Jesus saying the truth sets you free, and you hear what we're hearing tonight, what do you think, Tom?
That they're not really relating to God because they aren't accepting his moral laws and truth, and so they're still in bondage, just like paganism. They're bondage to their false beliefs and actually separate from God, and all they have to do to look forward to is that physical death. But God also promised a resurrection from the dead.
But, Tom, what about the notion Jack Beattie expressed earlier that he feels in these stories, people looking for something that goes beyond the cold rationality of death in many directions? Simply misguided, in your view?
Yes. No one can escape the reality that sin brings death. And God destined everyone to experience that reality because he has to bring all people to judgment, meaning anyone who transgresses God's laws experiences death.
Tom, we've got the perspective. Let me put it to my guests, and thank you for your call. Jeff Charlotte, how about it? Tom's looking from a Christian perspective and saying what he's hearing here is a lot of misguided people and who haven't found the truth in his view. Did you find in your journeys that, I don't know, what portion of people that you ran into had this kind of firm line drawing in their view of spirituality today? Is Tom a mainstream view in what you found or not?
Tom is a mainstream view. Evangelical Christianity, of which he sounds like a representative, is huge and growing. At the same time, so many of those Christians who might get dismissed as fundamentalist Christians and not very thoughtful are in many ways compassionate and innovative and doing more interesting things than we expected, like cowboy Christianity, which sounds kind of campy, at the same time is bringing in all these strands of environmentalism into a kind of orthodox evangelical Christianity.
The cowboy Christians have environmentalism at the heart of what they're preaching?
Some of them do. You mentioned a cousin of yours, and I'm not sure where that is in his practice. The church that we spent some time with down in Texas was a rancher, and they took very seriously the portions of Genesis which talk about being shepherds of the earth. And, yeah, they would pay sort of lip service to the mainstream Christianity, but they were really very interested in the land and their ranches and the prairie and the cows they took care of, and that as a model for relating to others and to the divine.
Jack Beattie, a couple hundred years ago, the family lore is there was a primitive Baptist preacher named Ashbrook somewhere in the Carolinas, but I have to say I've sort of fallen off of that that line here. But wow, what a lot of stories we get tonight. A real just ball of energy, people looking many ways outside that iron cage of rationality you mentioned.
Yes, and you know, Fred used the quote of the phrase, the truth will set you free. And the authors point out that in one version of Christianity, there were 365 gods. There was a god for every day. There were 365 truths, you might say. And it's the truth part of religion that I think gives so many of us such pause. The truth, there is no the truth. I'm much more at home with this notion of my house having many my mansion having many doors, whatever that phrase is.
Well, because
once human beings have the notion of the truth, then sometimes some very nasty things can happen.
Well, Jack, what a country we live in where there is clearly the truth and many truths all running around side by side. Peter Manso and Jeff Charlotte, authors of Killing the Buddha. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And Jack, thanks for being with us up there.
Thank you.
We're going to end the hour tonight with an excerpt from Killing the Buddha. The book is punctuated by modern-day interpretations of several stories from the Bible. In this excerpt, writer Rick Moody reworks the story of Jonah and the whale, recasting Jonah as a young Jewish gay man from Queens or Brooklyn, New York. The excerpt begins as a tempest rages around Jonah's boat.
Above, in the cabin where all the windows have been shattered, where passengers bled and moaned and gnashed their teeth and huddled in a small maintenance closet, the captain laid out his vision for orderly abandonment of the craft. I have a number of these matchsticks that I use for toothpicks, and I've busted one of these very matchsticks down to a nub, and we're going to draw lots from these, one person, one matchstick. I propose that we outfit with these remaining orange life jackets all those who manage to avoid the accursed nub. Of the 12 miserable gamblers in the maintenance closet, all agreed to the plan, naturally, as it had a betting aspect. They cast lots, and the nub, as if the captain had fixed the game, fell to Jonah Feldman. These gamblers had their schemes. They had their racing forms. They had their ideas about the order of things. They knew prophets and prophecy. And when Jonah Feldman was revealed through instantaneous possession of the nub as a man of particularly dark luck, the gamblers fell upon him in a fierce inquiry into his significance. An older man with cracked spectacles and excessive amounts of cologne offered a brief, kind word before demanding, "Just clue us in here. What's with the instantaneous hurricane? And what's your job? And where do you come from? And where are you going? And what is your ethnic and racial self-description? And why have you brought us to this dark place?" Jonah Feldman cried out to them all, "I'm a Jew, and I'm a homosexual person. I'm both, and I won't dissemble here, even if you should throw me over the side. And I fear the Lord, I mean the actual God in heaven, author of both sea and dry land, also author of the results of games of chance and presidential elections, likewise author of the stars and equations of physics, including Planck's constant." They didn't want to throw Jonah to his doom because they figured it too would be impossibly bad luck, and because it seemed morally dubious, but neither did they want him on the boat. So Jonah said to them, "Take me up and throw me into the sea, since it's for my sake that this tempest is upon you." By which he meant that there's always a tempest and always a culpable party, and he was willing to be done with the brief interval of his promising life and proofreading job at Price Waterhouse. He was willing now to be courageous and dead, for tempests are full of revelation. He had done what he ought not. He had avoided his duty, and so he must perish. Just then there was a violent rolling of the craft, and a wave of such magnitude that it was as if a sheet were drawn over them, and gamblers and crew and captain alike knew that their destruction was imminent. They picked up Jonah Feldman, humbled and resigned, and they shoved him through the shattered portal, into the fathomless deep, into the dark draperies of the underworld, and he was gone. Whereupon the sea ceased from raging.
I woke up this morning kind of blue, thinking through that age-old question, how to exit a well digestion. It might behoove me.
Into the water Jonah Feldman tumbled, into the tempestuous water, according to which there was no up and down, nor east and west, just expanses of darkness, which compassed about him even to his soul. And he felt the last bit of air in him bubbling forth. He saw the jumble of images from his life. His tukis smacked in the Long Island Jewish hospital, his bar mitzvah, and the speech he gave there on the subject of the New York Yankees and their relation to certain passages from the Talmud, such as, "It is forbidden to live in a town that does not have a green garden." The fish was Leviathan. In particular, it was the blessed blue whale, hunted at the edge of its elimination from this world, and it bore down upon him. Preliminarily, the Lord had actually contacted the blue whale, asking for indulgence in this matter. "Friend whale, can I bother you to swallow this particular human being for a brief interval? I know you are an eater of plants and a peaceful being, and I know you fear for your life, as there are anglers in pursuit of you, but this human being needs some 3 days to reflect and atone, and I would prefer him to spend time where the surroundings provide for both revelation and the great delicacy known as fish cheese." The whale replied, "Happy to serve, as I must."
A modern retelling of Jonah and the Whale by Rick Moody from Killing the Buddha, read here by On Point's Chris O'Connor. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.